what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. This week's guest is Frank Martin. Now, if you watch this entire thing, you're gonna love the story of when he got offered the Kansas State job. I didn't know it. I'm not sure he's told it. It's pretty cool. Frank and I talked for about an hour, and he agreed to do a second part. We'll probably do it today or tomorrow. I mean, we ain't doing much right now. And we'll get into kind of more of the kind of present day, what happened and went right and then went wrong, Kansas State to South Carolina to the Final Four to where we are now. And then I have some other kind of quirky stuff to ask Frank. It's pretty amazing. He's an amazing, amazing guy. So we'll get to Frank Martin in just a couple moments. First, let me kind of quickly recap for you the NBA draft. Now, I think what's fascinating is the LaMelo Ball deal. We can talk about other guys, but obviously he's a huge name. I guess the good thing is, if you look at it, like his dad had two top three picks that are sons. That's incredible. And the first time I saw LaMelo Ball play, I think he was in seventh grade, maybe eighth. And I'll never forget, I was coaching one of my dad's teams at the American Sports Center, which is in Anaheim. And I got done coaching and I went over and Miles Simon grabbed me. He's now an assistant with the Lakers. And Miles like, have you seen the Ball Brothers play? I was like, no, I don't even know who that is. Like, let's go watch. We went over to the court, full of people. And I love the way that Lonzo found people. I love the way that LaMelo found people. And LaMelo was playing up, playing against high school kids. And he was tiny with big floppy hair. And it's always fascinating to me on how guys who play up the skill that they have. And I know this from me playing up. When I was in fourth grade, I played with my brother's eighth grade team. And I think what that does is it does make you, you have to be more of a passer because you can't score on people. The downside to that is that, especially nowadays in the NBA, you got to be a bit of an alpha scorer. Do I want people that set people up? Yeah, but I need you to take over games. And then when help comes, you kick off. James Harden, LeBron James, like LeBron James, he's not a scorer per se, but he, man, his career is the all-time leading NBA scorer. So let's first take Lonzo and why it hasn't worked. First, if we're honest, LeVar didn't train him right, you know? Yes, he trained him to be able to play in transition and encouraged him to pass. And he's got great passing vision. And Lonzo has bought into when they played growing up, it was all about pressing and getting steals. And he really didn't refine, learn to play defense until the NBA. But Lonzo is a very good defender and wants to be a great defender. He's also a very good rebounder for a guard. But what he's never done is had the willingness or ability to take over a game offensively. Obviously, his jump shot has held him back. But so does he's not a good finisher. He's just not. And then you factor in some bad luck, injuries. Now, I don't know if the first injury when he was in the NBA, some people believe it's because he wore those crummy big baller brand shoes. But whatever it was, he was hurt both his first offseason when he got drafted by the Lakers and the next offseason. That's when you make your biggest jump is – you learn what to do, what not to do, how to work on your game, how to change his body, but he's never been able to truly take those steps in the offseason. Then you look at the bubble this year, and he was awful, which leads me to believe that during quarantine, he wasn't doing the work. That's the only Jamal Murray can't become, go from a very good player to an elite level player after quarantine, if not for putting in a ton of work during quarantine, as opposed to Lonzo Ball, who went from being a starter to a guy who now New Orleans went and drafted a point guard and traded for a point guard. If you think they think that Lonzo Ball is future, why they actually traded for two point guards. I don't know if George Hill stays there or retires or buy him out or whatever, but you don't bring in three point guards unless if you think that you got your star of the future, right? So his career kind of hangs in the balance there with a GM that didn't draft him, a coach that didn't draft him as well. But Lonzo didn't know how to play pick and roll until after being in the NBA a couple of years. Still not a very good finisher, not a confident shooter. And he has made his body a pretty good body, but he kept breaking down. So now let's go to LaMelo. LaMelo is bigger and as good or a better passer. Seems to have a great creative finishing knack. Part of it is he's very big. Now, I don't know how his body feels out. If he can become the explosive athlete that Lonzo's become, stands to reason, probably, right? He's only 18. Right now, it's all about length, and he's wiry, and he adds, he's not going to be slow-mo his whole career. But Lonzo has always tried to play defense. LaMelo doesn't play any defense, doesn't like contact. And if you want to say that Lonzo's shot was broke, like LaMelo's shot looks very similar, and the numbers are terrible. Even in Australia, we saw highlights and snippets, and he does some amazing things with the basketball, but he shot 25% from three. I expect that to improve. I do think that he's big. He has positional size, even more so than Lonzo. And if he's not hurt in the offseason, and if he's willing to put in the work that Lonzo, I don't think put in the work, I think he'd be really good. But I don't know for a fact. I don't know for a fact that it absolutely works out. It's a risky pick. I like that it's out of a big market, and that it's going to be about kind of buying in. I don't love the fit there because I think Devontae Graham is – now, Devontae Graham truthfully is a perfect sixth man, and because of his lack of size, he can play with Zoe, and he's not a creative point guard. He's a dynamic scoring guard. I think that's where Charlotte should go, right? Whereas Terry Rozier is a bench player. I don't care what his salary tells you. When he was at his best in Boston is when he came off the bench. There's a reason they didn't think they could elevate him to a starter. There's a limit there. Doesn't have a great roster around him. I question, is all of a sudden he's going to decide to defend? All of a sudden, you cannot teach toughness. You can change a guy's body. You can change a guy's shot. You can't teach a guy toughness. And it's really hard to get a guy to have great work ethic. I think he has good work ethic. I think that's why he has so much skill in what he's done. But I don't think he has great work ethic. I don't think he has great toughness. So I wonder what that looks like. Maybe my favorite pick of the draft is Nico Mannion going to the Warriors. One of the things about Steph Curry is we've been searching for a Steph Curry backup since what, Leandro Barbosa aged and then eventually went away. One of the reasons there's such a massive drop off when Steph has come off the court with the Warriors was he had like Quinn Cook as his backup. Quinn's a G leaguer who made the NBA, obviously won an NBA title this year with the Lakers, but they just didn't re-sign him. And so this is not to take a shot at Quinn Cook, but he's a third or fourth point guard on the team. They didn't have a viable, you're not going to get a 1B to Steph, but a guy who could eventually be a starter. That's what Nico Mannion is. Does he need to make better decisions? Sure. Does he need to shoot the ball better? Sure. He's not obviously not the passer, Steph, and you're not going to teach that. But I like, he's got some juice to him. And while I love Peyton Pritchard, I think he's tough. I don't know. First round seems a little high. I love Nico Mannion, and I think that's a terrific fit for him, because if you look at the Warriors roster now, how many ball handlers do they actually have? They used to have five guys. Remember, Kevin Durant was like a point forward. Draymond Green still there, like a point forward. The worst dribbler ball handler, the guy who dribbled the least, was Klay Thompson, right? But you don't have so many guys that they had that could handle the basketball, and you're going to need more guards because Steph, while he's technically a point and brings it up, he's also technically a two guard really, and he needs somebody else. And you can play those two together. I believe you can play those two together if Nico can learn to be a very good defense. You got to be a really good defense player, and he's tough. So I like that draft pick. I like what the Timberwolves did, believe it or not. I thought Anthony Edwards was the right pick. Wiseman, they couldn't use another big. And I didn't like LaMelo with D'Angelo Russell. Obviously, I have the questions that everybody has about a guy who says he doesn't love basketball. And I'm not sure he'll become a great shooter, but he's an explosive athlete with a big, strong football body. Does Anthony Edwards become an all-star? Maybe not. Does he become a damn good 18-20 game scorer? Probably. And maybe beyond, but it depends upon how hard he wants to work. And also, this is a challenge to D'Angelo Russell, a guy who was a hangout guy with the Lakers, got a terrible reputation in terms of his work ethic and buy-in off the court. Does he buy in now? I hope he does, because now he's a max contract guy and he's got to make it work because people think Kyle Anthony Towns wants to go to the Knicks. So otherwise, free agency-wise, look, here's what we'll do. We'll record one next week when some of the dust settles. We'll see if Gordon Hayward gets to the Pacers. We'll see if it's a sign and trade or if it's signed right away. We'll see what happens with the Lakers. Right now, I really like what they've done. Dennis Schroeder, that guy can score off the dribble. That guy can score off the catch. Pretty tough-minded. Obviously, he wasn't great as an alpha at a young age in Atlanta, but found a good role last year in Oklahoma City. And he's a, this would be a good role for him. And I don't believe for one second that Anthony Davis is going to sign anywhere else. This feels like clutch sports trying to get the Lakers to sign more clutch guys. That's what it is. I don't know if it works. It does feel like Rob Pelinka's got pretty good control and understanding of the situation. You may have to sign one guy or two guys to pacify everybody, but Anthony Davis isn't leaving a championship team with a chance to win multiple championships with LeBron. Especially now, the West is not as good as we thought it would be. Like Portland, they're not losing to Portland. Houston seems to be done. I love Denver, but there's a ceiling there. Utah, same thing. It's the Clippers and the Lakers. And who else? Whereas the East, the Nets are real. The Bucks are real. The 76ers real. Although, I mean, Danny Green can't be a starter. Can't move. Unless he finds a fountain of youth. Didn't move well. Missed a lot of shots. A lot of open shots this year. And as much as everybody loves Seth Curry making the NBA, he's a great shooter. He's got to come off the bench because he can't guard. And he's not a starting caliber. He's a very good bench shooter. Korver. That's who he is. Awesome. But they still need some more pieces to go along with Tobias Harris in the big two. All right, let's get to my Frank Martin interview. Frank Martin, I've known him for a long time. We'll get to that story at some point in either this interview or the next interview. He's the head coach of South Carolina. A couple years ago, they went to a Final Four. He is the son of Cuban dissidents, and he has an amazing personal story. This is part of two parts with Frank Martin. Enjoy. Well, Coach, first, how are you? Like, how's your health? How's your team? This is a crazy set of circumstances. How are you?
I'm doing great, Doug. You know, it's like everyone else. It was an interesting spring and summer. Getting older, everything hurts. We've been, knock on wood, going at it here for really hard for the last 5 weeks. And we've been responsible and safe up to this point from COVID. So we just got to keep our fingers crossed and take it day by day and hope we can, get through a season. And but I'm doing great, man. My family's healthy. Bored. I'm just in a gym and in my house, nowhere else. But, you know, other than that, it's okay.
Okay. So in terms of the gym, when you're on quarantine, did you? You know, I talked to Bill Self and he actually cleaned the garage 3 times. and he said, I might have done it too well. Is there a hobby or anything you picked up, especially when you didn't have practice that you hadn't done previously?
I pretty much played golf more than at any time in my life in the month of April. And then early May hit, I was getting ready for knee replacement. And that's when I tested positive for COVID. And who the heck knows if I was positive or not? I mean, it's unbelievable. You just don't know. I think I was, cause I felt kind of weird. And I don't know if you like my new hairdo, but
I like it a lot.
I got hit by alopecia really bad. So, which they say it's a after effect of COVID, whether it's stress or the disease itself.
Wow.
So I just, about 2 weeks ago, I just finally, rather than hide it, I cut it off. And then I did have my knee replacement, I worked at the house a little bit. I'm not very good at things at the house. I work hard at being a husband. I work hard at being a dad, but I absolutely stink at anything that deals with, being a handyman or fixing things around the house. So, I tried.
Okay, so when you say I played more golf than I've ever played, did you grow up playing golf?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I played some, I started hitting balls when I was like a junior in high school, just cause there's a range fairly close to the house and the AD at my high school used to play. So he'd take me with him. But I never really got into golf until my 20s. And then when I got into college basketball, I stopped. I barely played. I played some in Kansas towards the end of my time there. And then when I got here, I stopped playing again. I just trying to rebuild this program. I had no time for golf and I got young children. Yeah. But, you know, we were in COVID and that was about the only thing that we can do in the lockdown is go play golf. And so I did that a lot.
You mentioned your kids and your family. It was, and there can be too much of that, but especially for college basketball and a guy like yourself, a grinder, you did spend a lot of time on the road recruiting and, you know, and with your coaches in your office. It had on some level be refreshing to be able to be at home and there's no distractions. Like we had family dinners that we had never had. And I don't have nearly the schedule that you have. I'd have to imagine that was pretty rewarding, but also pretty different from the lifestyle you've led since you got into college hoops.
Well said, Doug. It's that was the one thing. I did a show with your peers on FS1, Marcellus Wiley, and at the time Jason Whitlock, and they kind of asked me a similar question, and I told them, I said, you know, I work really hard at trying to be a father. And being really involved in my children's life and helping them and being there for them. And when COVID hit, I actually got to separate from work and life and just worry about them. And I realized that as hard as I tried, I really didn't know my kids real good. They knew me, but I didn't know them. And so from that standpoint, it was unbelievably helpful. To really get to know my kids, which after the fact, I felt real guilty about. So now that we're, I don't want to say we're back to normal, but you know, I'm coaching again, I'm practice. I'm getting ready to start traveling. I have a better understanding what they like, don't like, how they do things. And it's all because of what you said. We got to eat family dinners together. You know, we spent quality time talking. We're all in the house. So it was pretty powerful.
So you grew up in Miami. Give me, paint the picture of what your childhood was like.
A lot of fun, a lot of joy, very simple. We you know, we didn't travel. We barely got out of our neighborhood. While my dad was still in our lives, I believe my mom's probably going to get mad at me for getting the number wrong, but I think we moved 15 times in 11 years.
Why so much?
Just my dad was just all over the place, and we you know, moved neighborhood to neighborhood and trying to get a better deal, I guess. I don't know. Just following his lead. And, you know, part of the moves was also that he left home on two different occasions. So then my mom would move back closer to her mother, which always lived in our neighborhood where I ended up spending a lot of time with at growing up. And but it was simple. You know, my family outside of my father, my family was we were ecstatic. You know, I've learned a lot in the last 4 or 5 months with the stuff that's going on in the country. Because I'd always viewed life in this country through my lens. And I've had to learn how to view it through everybody's lens. And in my lens, I don't understand why people were unhappy with stuff in this country. Because this country gave my family an opportunity to live in freedom, to allow me to get educated for free, to go on at least through high school and then go on to college and now become a Division I basketball coach when my family had no pedigree in academics in this country. And, you know, so, but we were a simple neighborhood, man. We all looked out for one another, nothing easy, but we didn't know because all we had was love, you know, our families, they loved us. They loved each other. We the neighborhood took care of one another. Our coaches, at the high school had been our coaches since we were like 11 and 12 years old, and they lived in the neighborhood and they grew up in the neighborhood. So, that's all we had, and it's all we knew, and we were at peace with it and real happy.
Okay. How have you reconciled the issues with your father? Like, how do you obviously, as a father yourself, and I'm sure I get it, there's the guilt of, and I didn't even know my kids until quarantine. Sure. But you are a good man. You are a good father and a good husband. How have you reconciled? Because so oftentimes, you know, when you have that in your past, you carry it with you as a burden, but it also becomes, in some levels, who you are as a dad or who you are. How have you reconciled the dad issues, for lack of a better term, that you had growing up?
Yeah, I, you know, as a kid, I always wondered why is he doing this? Why does he act the way he acts? Why is he gone? Why don't, you know, he care? Why did he disappear and never care for us after a certain date? As a man, I understand divorce. I get it. I comprehend that we grow up as adults, and sometimes, even though there's love, we need to kind of get away from one another. I kind of understand that. I don't understand how, as a man, you can get away from your children and leave your children behind. But I'm at peace, man. I'm a man now. I'm older. I comprehend that we make decisions as men. Some are good, some are bad. And the one thing we can't do is look in the rearview mirror and go backwards. We have to learn and move forward. So I'm at peace with the decisions he made. I'm lucky. My mother had a brother, my uncle, that he served as that male influence in my life. And then I lived in a neighborhood where, like I said, our coaches were our men. They still lived in the neighborhood. So they
so,
weren't
so just, like who is your basketball? Who was your basketball coach when you're in high school?
Yeah. Marcus Shaky Rodriguez. And then his assistant, who's a principal at another school now, Jose Nunez, whose son is the AD at New Mexico, Eddie Nunez. They lived in the neighborhood. They were our coaches since we were like 10, 11, 12 years old. So when you misbehaved at home, you didn't have to worry about the next day. They come get you at the house, and they made you respect your home and respect what your mother said. So I'm fortunate. I'm at peace with my dad, whatever decisions he made. He's still alive. He and I have not had a conversation since late 70s, 78, 79. But it is what it is. I'm lucky. I've had other men in my life that filled that role.
Okay. First time you met Shaky was when and where?
I was a kid. There was a basketball league, at the old Orange Bowl. On their parking grounds, there was a basketball court, and there's an organization that's worldwide, they're nationwide, the Kiwanis Club. One of their branches was in our neighborhood. It's called the Kiwanis Club of Little Havana, and they sponsored a basketball league. And Shaky was one of the guys that at the time he was like, you know, in his mid 20s, and he was one of the coaches at the league. And, you know, we were the kids, you know, and we all lived in the same neighborhood. So that's the first time I met him. And, you know, and then just you're around them, and then you get to high school, and now you're around them more. And, you know, powerful man. And as you know, you're aware, he just passed away 2 weeks ago of an aneurysm. And, but he without him, a lot of us don't succeed, because he was our father.
No question. I mean, he's kind of an amazing person in how many people are connected to the sport and then connected to each other.
Yep.
What was he like as a basketball coach? You guys were very, very successful when you were on his staff, before you were on his staff. He was incredibly successful. What was he actually as a basketball coach? What was he like?
You know, when you're a kid, you're like, man, why is this guy so hard, so difficult? You know, he's on you. And, you know, he'd make you – Shaky's biggest thing when you were a kid, he'd make you play one-on-one. And you couldn't fight, and you couldn't quit. If you did either, he'd throw you out of the park, and you couldn't come back. And so you had to learn how to – compete and get better. And I couldn't play a lick, but if I fought, he send you home. If you quit, he send you home. And you don't want to let him down, because he worked so hard on the other side to instill trust in you and belief in you. I tell people all the time, you know, we're all Cuban kids from a real Cuban neighborhood in Miami. Basketball was not a Cuban sport. We were all about baseball in my family. And then as kids in the neighborhood in the 70s, it was all about the Miami Dolphins and Larry Zonka. That was my guy. I wanted to be Larry Zonka. And here's Shaky trying to teach us to play basketball. And but he whether – here's the other thing. I said this to – I can't remember who I was. It was part of our racial reconciliation group in the NABC. At a young age, I never understood that we were different as people because whether you were white, Hispanic, black, Puerto Rican, whatever, he treated us all like we were one and the same. And he made us understand we needed one another to succeed. And then he had us all thinking we were no good. He had us thinking that if Magic and the Lakers would have walked into the Miami Senior High Gym in 1981, we had a chance to win. That's what he had us thinking. And we had one guy on that team play Division I basketball, Anthony Grant, one guy, but he had us thinking that we were that good. But that's who he was. He was really hard on us, but he made us believe in ourselves and invested all kinds of faith in us.
So Miami Senior High, and I didn't know this until the Super Bowl, really. I didn't realize it's on South Beach. What is that little island, that little strip called?
No, it's just, you got South Beach and then you got the Bay and then you got downtown Miami. And then you've got our neighborhood, which is just west of downtown Miami. You're as close to downtown as you can possibly be.
Okay. So you go
then
there.
Key Biscayne might be what you're talking about, which is slightly just to the east of us.
So, so you play in high school. Were you good? Personally?
No.
Did you start?
No. Doug, I was pathetic. That's why Shaky was so incredible. I was an awful basketball player. And he kept me around. I have no idea why. Kept me around. Now, I wanted to try. And I played nothing but football and baseball until I got to 10th grade. And then I fell in love. Our high school is the second oldest high school in the state of Florida. It's the winningest high school basketball team in the history of the state of Florida. So we walk in this old Spanish architecture gymnasium. It's called the Asylum. And walked in there. And the place, I'm a ninth grader. And at the time, it was junior high. You're not in high school in ninth grade back then. And there's no Miami Heat. There was no Miami Marlins. There was no Division I basketball in this, nowhere. All we had was high school basketball. And you walked in this gym and it was wall to wall. And I was like, holy cow, I want to play basketball. You know, I want to do this. And he kept me around. I was awful. He kept me around. He actually, my senior year in high school, tried to convince me that he can get me a scholarship at the University of Florida with Norm Sloan and Monty Tyler to be a manager. And I was like, no, Shake, I want to play. I need to try and play. And I did. I tried to go to junior college at Miami-Dade and play. And got cut. And that's how this whole coaching thing got started. I got cut and tore up my knee at the same time. Bad.
So then you went to FIU, right? But you weren't, were you a manager? Were you on the staff? Like how did your existence like?
No, 1984, I get cut from the team at Miami-Dade Community College. The walk-on tryouts before the season. And then I'm trying to stay in shape. I was going to give it one more go. And then I tear my knee up over Christmas playing pickup basketball. And I quit school. I quit everything. And Shaky found out that I quit school. So he calls me and he's like, hey, I need you to go back to school. And you got to understand, nobody in my family had ever attended college. So going to college was not in the list of things that I was told growing up. It was, you know, get your education, respect school, get a job. So I was like, the only time in my life I ever said no to him. I said, Shake, I can't do it. I'm going to just keep working. I was working at a bank. I'm going to keep working and help my mom pay bills. And he was like, come by and see me. So I went by.
What were you doing at the bank? You're like a teller?
Proof operator. That job's non-existent. That means all the checks that are deposited into the bank, they end up on me. And I've got to sit there and encode check after check after check. To balance check deposits for all the businesses at the bank. And so I went to see him And he said, if you're not going to go back to school, why don't you come around and help me coach? I was like, man, it's South Beach. I'm getting ready. I was 19. I'm like, I want to hang out on South Beach. I want to make money, help my mom, and do the streets. Man, that's the life. And he says, come by and help me coach. Well, our JV coach at the time is someone I'm pretty sure you know, Sergio Rocco, also from our neighborhood. And so I become Sergio's assistant JV coach. And I fell in love with it, man. And then Sergio left at the end of that year to become a head coach at another high school in town. And in typical shaky fashion, he never even asked me if I wanted to be the JV coach. He said, hey, Friday, I need you to meet me. We're driving to Orlando. I said, for what? So we're going to a coaching clinic. I need you to learn. And that's how the whole thing got started in 1985, man. And never looked back. And it's all because of him.
Weren't you a bouncer at some point in time?
Yeah, I did that. Trying to South Beach was happening, man. That's
no, I got it. It's
that's 1983, 84. That's when South Beach started. And you know, that's when that whole Miami nightlife was coming off. You got to understand, it's coming off the '70s, which is the whole, you know, that's when Miami took off, the nightlife part of it, because of the drug scene and all that in the '70s. And then South Beach became popular, and, you know, so I landscaped, washed dishes at restaurants. My first job was when I was 12 years old. And it was taking subscriptions to the Miami Herald. A van would pick me up in front of my house and drop me off in some neighborhood. And I go door to door, sell subscriptions. I do that 3 nights a week. Now I was a change boy at the local pool hall. I've done it all, man. I've you name the job, I've done.
So I want to work back to basketball in a second, but this is important because, as you said, we all look at it through this tunnel, right? Of as you were raised in a Cuban neighborhood where there wasn't really excuses made. Like, you had to go out and work, you had to get a job, you had to make money, you had to work hard, you had to get good grades. And if you want to play ball, you got to go play ball. There wasn't. And then, of course, you have everything that's taken place in our country over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months, which I think has been building over time.
No doubt.
How do you balance out the fact that, like, look, your family came here as exiles with nothing, and you made it, and you continue to make it. It's part of the culture. But look, my great great grandparents came here on the boat with nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand that there are different things that hold different people back, but when you're talking with your players about the challenges that they're going to face in their life, but also about the gifts and the privileges that they've earned, but through basketball, how do you convey what you've been able to accomplish with limited means and what they can accomplish with limited means?
Yeah, I've been talking to players about that since 1985. Because that's all I ever knew in my neighborhood, and whether we were, you know, the Miami River separated the Cuban neighborhood from the Black neighborhood, which is over town, and our high school was comprised of both neighborhoods, and so it's I've been talking to our teams and players about that forever, but this is the perspective that I had to understand, and I didn't comprehend this until this past summer. I've thought about it, but I never really understood It was really confusing to me, you know, how somebody can say this country holds you back and doesn't allow you to succeed. And I'm saying, well, look at me. If I can do this, anybody can. What? Well, sure. Here's the perspective. The perspective is that my family left a country that oppressed them, that took away everything they owned, and basically took their everything but the ability to be alive away from them. And if they questioned anything, they would have taken their lives too. And this country gave my family an opportunity to start from scratch, have freedom to work, live, and make the best of yourself however you choose to. Well, I had to sit back and take a deep breath and realize when African Americans start talking about some of the stuff that is still wrong, well, they're trying to figure out how to make it right in the same country where there was oppression up until 1960, you know, 4 or 5, where some things are still, you know, they were enslaved in this country, their family members. And up until the 60s, you know, some stuff was really bad. And there's still some things that aren't right. I had to kind of put myself in a place. Well, imagine if I had to go back and live in Cuba under Fidel Castro's regime and try to act like I'm comfortable with what he has done to people in Cuba. And I said, yo, that doesn't make any sense. I don't think I'd be able to do that. I want out unless that regime completely changed, which has given me perspective to better understand my players and where they're at and make the conversation to comprehend that there are some things. This is the way I word it to our team now, Doug. Some people run the 100-yard dash. Others, like myself, we run the 110-yard hurdles. And it's still a race, and nothing's preventing you from running the race. Some of us just have hurdles. Well, it's our job, like me. I've been able to clear a bunch of hurdles. Get those out of the way so the next person like me can run the 100-yard dash. And, you know, but I try to tell our players, it's okay to speak on what you believe. It's okay to share what life has taught you, but also be willing to listen to what life has taught others. Because that's the one thing that's beautiful. Hey, Doug, here's the beautiful thing. And, you know, and you and I got to know each other, obviously, through your dad. And your dad and Shaky were kind of similar in how they went about life with kids and basketball and helping people. And life in California is a heck of a lot different than life in Miami. They're both sunny and nice weather, but people live completely different ways. And then life in New York and Miami and the Midwest, in this country, man, we all have freedom, but we live in completely different cultures and different styles of life in different parts of it.
There's no question. I think, though, the question becomes, the thing about your family and the thing about what you've told your players and taught your players for years, even going back to the high school days, is the value of education. And I think sometimes we're working against ourselves. This has been I believe that the greatest inequality in our country that remains is education inequality.
Hands down.
That the education you get in a good neighborhood as opposed to the education you get in a bad neighborhood, regardless of race, it's a socioeconomic thing. And you know, the thing that I'm most proud of as being Jewish is Judaism is 100% literate culture. It is unacceptable to not be literate and to not push yourself in academia on some level, right? Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of downsides. There's downsides to the Jewish culture that some parts of it that I don't like and I don't agree with. I think that's with any culture. And my parents, for example, like they were a no excuses, like you're going to get good grades. I don't remember my mom or dad ever sitting down with me and doing my homework like we do with our kids, but there's just do it. You can do it. You can do the work. Do the work. When I had a reading issue when I was in elementary school, I got a reading specialist from a public school and I got better. And that's the way. And then my dad would give me, he would give me one sports book. And then when I'd finish that one, he would give me one. Like I remember reading The Boys from Brazil, Leon Uris, when I was in sixth grade. It was amazing. And that was how I got to be a better reader. Anyway, your family, you to your family and to your players, you preach education. I feel like, especially the basketball culture, so much of it is about getting paid. How can I get paid? Right? From when you're in AAU, can I get my shoes? Can I get my gear? Can I get a little side money? You get to college basketball and it's how quickly can I get from here to where I'm making money? Where the change that'll occur with your whole family for the rest of your life. Yeah, you can become a pro, but the doors that are open when you embrace yourself in the culture of education, like how do we reward the great players as they should be to be professionals, but also to the 99% others or 95% others, let them understand that they're getting the gift of a chance at an education. I think people also assume that education means like that you learn something in school. It's about who you're around. It's about problem solving. It's about understanding kind of social jujitsu of people from different backgrounds at a university, as well as managing time, managing your money, all of these things come together. How do we, I guess, reconcile that education is really important and somehow it gets lost in this conversation about players needing to feel, or maybe us as adults feeling like they should be compensated for their work.
Doug, I wish I can state it any better than what you just said. I say it, I tell our players, and the verbiage I use is education is the difference between the haves and the have nots. And that's not skin color. That's not one race or another. That's amongst Cuban folks in Miami back in the day. There were Cuban folks that made it a lot sooner than others, and it was because they moved to the suburbs and got better educations than us in our neighborhood. Now, I'll use my, to your point, that one of the first things I've, Tommy Amaker and I've tried to do with the Committee on Social Reconciliation, of racial reconciliation, is eliminate SAT and ACTs. That's not a representation of how intelligent you are. That's a representation of your socioeconomic background and where you're at. My parents had no money for tutors, and I just went to the local public school in our neighborhood where it was hard. I had, my SAT was 780. My daughter, like, she's my blood, as an eighth grader, her SAT as an eighth grader is an 1100. Why? She's got my blood in her. Why? Because she's grown up in a different neighborhood than I did, in a different school system, and she's had access to tutors and all the stuff you just spoke about. But education is what it's all about. And you are absolutely right. We have, I'll make one more point here to what you're exactly saying. If you listen to our country, and there's a group of people that are trying, that always complain that we protect the top 2% earners in our country, and that we should create laws that penalized them for being the top 2% to take away their money to spread it amongst others. Okay. Yet in college basketball, we want laws to make the lives of the top 2% better and deprive the other 98%. It's a complete opposite. Like, what do I mean by that? Well, we're trying to change all the power of a college education is better for 98%. Well, we're getting ready to change all the rules and all the laws because of the guys, the 2% that become the NBA guys that have maximum.
They don't actually need it, right? Because
correct. Yes. Here's my thing with that whole deal. I get the fact that salaries of the guys, not everybody that has my job makes a lot of money. There's very few of us that make the money I make right now.
Right.
But I get it. So that number has gone up, and the scholarship numbers kind of stayed around the same. Even though we get all the perks, Doug, there's stuff our guys get you didn't get when you played at Notre Dame, yeah, or Oklahoma State. And so there's
there's parts to it that we don't, that aren't talked about. This, how many kids get into school, couldn't get into school on their own. That has a value.
Absolutely.
And then, like, tuition is skyrocketing, and whatever. We don't value those things, and. You know, like, I love the NCAA to continue to embrace international players coming over and staying in school. And, you know, I'm a transfer myself, but some of the transfer culture in that there are ways in which we should reward kids that stay in school, reward kids that do well in school. Heck, I'm not necessarily against, if a guy is actually going to get his graduate degree, why does he have to, if he's still representing the university and is a student, why does he have to leave? Doesn't have to leave. But it is interesting, the point that you're making, because I think some people think that if you pay an athlete, it will stop cheating. It won't, right? Because somebody's always going to want more, right? And the kid that can leave is going to leave. There's no way you're going to match up with the professional money. Mm-hmm. And I think we just so greatly undervalue the value of that time when you're in college, the time of, there's no parents, there's just your coach and your peers. In addition to which, when you get done, if you want to coach at a legit level, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to almost any truly reputable job, you're going to have some basis of college, if not a college degree. And we kind of brush over that because we feel like it's unfair that you, who've worked your entire professional life, like they'll point out, hey, Frank Martin makes X, right? He makes a couple million dollars. Like, okay, but Frank Martin for 15 years was a high school coach making nothing. And then when you went to Northeastern, Ron Everhart was the head coach, correct?
Rudy Keeling's the one that hired me. And then Rudy, we got fired 10 months later and Ron kept me.
Okay. So when you went to work for Rudy mm-hmm. in Boston, right? You've been in Miami your whole life. Mm-hmm. One, why'd you go?
I lost faith in where the public school system in Dade County was going. It wasn't a basketball thing. I lost faith in the direction that the public school system was going. And they were more concerned with test scores than they were with educating. They were more concerned with babysitting children than they were with demanding teachers do more. And that's not what I'm about. And that's what opened my ears. I said, you know what? I might as well try this basketball thing while I still got a chance.
Okay. So, did you call Rudy? Did you have a connection with Rudy? How'd that happen?
Charlton Young. I don't know if you remember Charlton on Leonard Hamilton's staff.
Sure.
Charlton was Rudy's assistant and Charlton's from Miami. He played high school basketball in Miami. I coached against him. And, when he played and he was recruiting our point guard and he called me and he says, hey, I'm going to take a job at Auburn before I recommend anybody. Coach really, really likes you. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, tell him I'd love to talk to him. And we did. And then I flew myself up to Boston to basically make him hire me. And he did. And away we were. $28,000 plus $5,000 for camp. And then we got fired in March. So the $5,000 for camp never happened because he got fired. So I didn't get to run the camp. So $28,000 to live in Boston.
Great okay. decision. Did you have to bring the point guard with you?
No, he went to Miami and I ended up then recruiting him when Ronnie kept me. He left Miami and he came to us as a transfer.
Okay. So you guys get fired. What was it like? What was that time like when Ron gets the job and you're kind of in limbo?
It was crazy. Ian McCall, who's the AD at Liberty, was our athletic director at the time. And he calls me in and he says, Frank, appreciate everything you've done in your 10 months here. We had to make the change. We're going to pay you for 2 weeks and you're done. And I'm going to encourage a new coach to give you a real look. And if he wants to keep you, great. And if not, I can't promise you anything. And I said, thank you. So he gave me 2 weeks pay of $28,000. And I was in Boston and I had a 1-year-old son in Miami whose mother and I had kind of split up. So I was going through that at the same time. And I had to pay his bills in Miami and now I'm unemployed and I know I got 2 weeks pay and that's it. And then, Ronnie, turns the job down. I didn't know Ronnie at the time. He and Hugs were really tight. I didn't know Ronnie at the time. And he turns the job down and they offer it to Glenn Miller, who was a Brown.
Sure.
And Glenn played for Calhoun at Northeastern. So there's a normal connection there. Glenn let me know if I take the job, Frank, I'm not going to keep you. Well, he ends up turning the job down 2 days later. So then they went back to Ronnie. Then he finally took the job in May. So I basically I lived from March, whenever we lost in the semifinal of conference tournament, March 10th or whatever, for 2 months on 2 weeks pay. It was hard. It was really, really hard.
And you just kept the guys together and you kept doing workouts or what were you doing?
I was unemployed. I was just living in Boston, fighting like heck, trying to find
You wouldn't come in? You wouldn't come into the office?
We got terminated. Yeah, we got terminated. We were told bye bye. 2 weeks pay, you're no longer employed. So it was hard. It was hard.
Okay, so Ron takes the job, and I mean, how did you guys get that thing going?
Ronnie Hugs convinces Ronnie to keep me, and Mick Cronin. Mick also knew Ronnie, and Mick and I to this day we're real good friends and. Mick called Ronnie and says, man, you got to keep Frank. And so Ronnie and I meet and he keeps me And there's another story about when he decided to keep me, which I'll share with you on a different date because it involves hogs and it's hilarious.
Wait, why are you No. You got to give it to me now.
Anyone that knows Ronnie, I didn't want to take up all your time on this story. Anyone that knows Ronnie.
This is better than asking. Everybody's asked you about the Final Four. I'd love to do Kansas State, but this to me is the stuff of, this is the stuff. This is okay. The basketball stuff that I love.
It's before he turns the job down. We're at the Final Four. He calls me and says, in Minneapolis, calls me and says, hey, come to my room. I want to meet with you. So I go to his room. We're in his room till 1:30 in the morning. We leave his room. Elevator hits the lobby. Doors open. Hugs is on the lobby floor. Hugs looks at us and says, you two guys together? He says, I'm quitting. I'm getting out of the business. And we start laughing. And Hugs says, I got to go to my room. I'll be right back. I'm getting cigars. So he goes to his room, comes back downstairs. We're waiting for him. We go to the bar. And now there's five of us sitting at the bar, L-shaped. And it's some guy we don't know, Hugs, and then us along this side of the bar. Ronnie's the last one. And Hugs is talking, and the guy next to Hugs says, there you go. You always got to be the loud mouth, blah, 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 blah. Hugs is like, come on, man. We're just sitting here having a good time amongst friends. Get him a drink. We're good, you know. And so Hugs buys the guy a drink, and, you know, we keep talking. 20 minutes later, the guy, Hug says something. The guy again says, man, I'm tired of hearing you. So Ronnie, who I just met that night, is next to me over here. Ronnie says to the guy, hey. And before Ronnie says a second word, the guy says, who the F are you? Well, Doug, before he said you, Ronnie had this guy by the head, smashing him against the bar top. And anyone that knows Ronnie knows he is one of the toughest SOBs in the business.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and I'm watching this and I'm saying, holy cow, I'm going to work with this guy. My God. And then that night he came over, he goes, hey, if I take the job, you're coming with me. And then he turned it down like the following week.
Right, and he's then killing you.
And then I'm still unemployed. And 3 weeks later, he takes the job.
How'd your relationship with Hugs come to be? He recruited one of your players?
He came in to recruit Cesar Portillo, who played for us at Miami Senior in 1988. But Cesar went to junior college. And Hugs got hired at Cincinnati in 1989, I want to say. And now he was recruiting Cesar during his sophomore year. We met at one of our practices at the high school. And then I went to a clinic that he was speaking at. When he was done, I went up to him. I'm a little JV coach. I'm 23 years old. I go up, hey, coach. He says, hey, Frank, how are you, man? Good to see you again. It blew me away. He remembered who I was. Well, he ends up hiring Mick. Mick and I were two of Sonny's guys that were running around all the time, looking out for Sonny. And Mick says to Hugs, hey, we got to bring Frank up here to Cincinnati. So they bring me to Cincinnati now. When Brent Wright, these are guys, Brent Wright, Andre Ferby, when those guys were playing high school for me. So I go up to Cincinnati, spend time with them. And then our friendship just continued to build over the years.
Brent Wright he's kind of on my list. I think he's the one. I don't know if you know the story, but in 2000, he's at Florida.
Yep.
And they're kicking our ass at the end of the game. And we're letting him dribble out the clock. And I think it was Brent Wright. And he goes in and dunks it right at the buzzer. Now, this is an amazing team. It's got your boy Udonis Haslem. It's got Mike Miller. It's got Teddy Dupe. It's got
Brett Nelson.
What was the left? Brett Nelson was a sophomore. What was the left-handed kid who was a one and done?
They had a guy named Justin Hamilton. They had
Justin
Harvey.
Hamilton, who became pro. Yeah, he got a bunch of offensive rebounds. We didn't. Yeah, Donnell Harvey. Was left-handed, like one and done. Anyway, Matt Brent Wright Bonner. Dunks the Matt Bonner, the Red Mamba. Yes, I'm a great team. I mean, they're better than us. They beat Duke in the Sweet 16. We wanted to play Duke because Duke had beaten us 2 years before, and they kicked our butt. But he dunks it at the buzzer to send him to the Final Four. He's like hanging on the rim, and we all wanted to fight because like, yo, you don't do that. Like, it's bad enough you beat us, but that's my Brent Wright story. So.
Hey, Doug, how about him? How about him again? From our pocket, our neighborhood, the whole thing. When he was retired from playing professionally, he started his own charter school in his own neighborhood, and now he's basically the guy that runs a school educating young kids in that neighborhood. Powerful.
Well, and then you have Udonis Haslem, like, still in the NBA and maybe the most respected player in the NBA for what he stands for and his leadership. He's like a remarkable human being.
Unreal. Fun guys.
Okay. So then you go and you work for Huggy. What was that experience like?
Yeah, Ronnie keeps me, and then we go sign Jose Juan Barea and we sign some other guys. A couple played for me in high school that were in junior college, and the transfer I told you about. So we get real good. I mean, we go beat West Virginia at West Virginia. We went down to Florida, lost to JJ, had knee surgery and played 6 days later. And we lose to Florida by six, I want to say. We kind of got it going, and we won over 20 games a couple years in a row. Ronnie and the new athletic director were butting heads. So Hugs has an opening on his staff. It's when Hugs was suspended because of the DUI at the time. Right. And Ronnie calls me in and says, hey, I'm going to go meet with Hugs in Cincinnati. I think I'm going to take that job. So he goes to Cincinnati, meets with Hugs. He's going to leave Northeastern as the head ball coach to go to Cincinnati to be with Hugs. And they went through it for about a week, and he decided not to take the job. So now I think, okay, good. At least I got a job. I've never been one, Doug, to call guys asking for jobs. I had a relationship with Hugs already. I'd always told them it's the way I do business. When I got that kind of relationship with somebody, I tell them, like, if you ever need me, I'm here. I'm not going to blow your phone up. And so I'm actually at the time I'm dating my present wife, the mother of my children, Anya. And it's a Friday in August, and we're having lunch at a little restaurant in Braintree, Massachusetts. And my phone rings, and it's Hugs. So I take the call, typical Hugs. Frank, what's up? Hey, I'm just dealing with this suspension. I get off of it in a couple of weeks. Da, 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 da. You know, we're just talking. And he says, you know, Ronnie is going to stay. Yeah, so obviously I know Hugs. I'm, you know, disappointed because I know, you know, what you mean to him and all that. He says, you know, I got to hire somebody because Dan Peters passed away, who's Hugs' guy, Pete. Dan left to go to Ohio State, and I got to get somebody I can trust. And he says, what do you think about you? And I said, Hugs, I've always told you, man, I'm never going to bother you with this. If you ever need me for anything, I'm here. All you got to do is ask. He says, well, I need you. So I hang up the phone, and I said, when? He goes, can you be here Monday? He was in Florida. He goes, can you be in Cincinnati on Monday? I said, yeah, send me a plane ticket. I said, let me call Ronnie. He goes, I already talked to him. He's aware. We're good. So I hang up the phone, and Anya says to me, what just happened? And we're just dating. We've been dating for like 3 months. And she says, what just happened? I said, I just took a job in Cincinnati. And she said, really? When you leave? I said, Monday. And she said, wow. What about me? And she, you got to understand, she had a high job. Like, she was the assistant director of financial services at the university. And so she had a job that made money. She's got a career. I mean, she's going. She says, what's that mean for me and us? And I said, I didn't know what to say. So we left the restaurant and got to her house. And I said, would you be willing to go? She says, if you ask me, I'll come. And in the back of my mind, I was like, this is the one. This is the one. If she's willing to help me chase my career and give up her career, are you kidding me? And away we went. So I took the job with Hugs, and she stayed behind because it was already late August. She stayed behind. She didn't want to leave her boss behind. With the start of the academic year, she wanted to make sure she did all that. And then she moves. Then it's AK, Hugs, Keith Legree, and I. And I'm like single. single professionally, not personally. And but Anya's not moving over to the following summer. Well, the following summer, AK and I are in the office. Huggs is working Jordan's camp in California. And I hear on the radio, Bob Huggins fired.
Fired.
And I walk over to AK and AK, are you listening to this? He's like, no, what? I said, they say just fired Huggs. I said, put the radio on. We put it on. Bob Huggins fired. So we start calling his attorney, Richard Katz, who's in Cincinnati. And he says, yeah, we're in the middle of this right now. Huggs don't even know. So we're calling Huggs in California. And now we're sitting there. It's August again the following year. My wife's been in town for 1 week. And here we are unemployed. And I'm saying, Jesus, Lord have mercy. What have I done to this poor lady? But it all worked out, man. Unbelievable ride.
All right. You're at Kansas State. Mm-hmm. And you guys had gone out and gotten completely in like one fell swoop, like changed the culture, unbelievable job in recruiting for 1 year. And then Huggs leaves. Take me through what happened so that you got the job.
Yeah. You know, Doug, if Huggs had stayed at Cincinnati, we had Michael Beasley, OJ Mayo, Billy Walker, DeJuan Blair, DJ Kennedy. All those guys were coming. It was done. They were all coming. So now we got to convince all of them, like, hey, it's not Cincinnati. It's Manhattan, Kansas. And Bill said, we're in. OJ dealt with the whole deal that everyone knows about now. And he decides to stay out west. DeJuan Blair, he said, man, I'm going to be too far from my grandma. So he stays home, goes to Pitt. DJ Kennedy goes to St. John's. He didn't want to go. If DeJuan didn't come, he didn't want to come to Manhattan, Kansas. But away we go. We signed some real good players. But that's while Huggs is the head coach. We had some pretty good players that had left behind, but they were all seniors. And now we get left out of the NCAA tournament. We deserve to be in that thing. The year Huggs was the head coach at K-State. Right. Unbelievable. Huggs is ridiculous, man. People don't understand, how good he is. You give him a bucket, and he's going to make something great with whatever's in the bucket. He'll figure out whatever's in that bucket and turn it into something great. And he unreal the job he did at K-State that year. And now we're at the Final Four, and I knew that the only job he'd ever leave K-State for was West Virginia. Right. I was with him. Arkansas called, offered him the job. He said, I'm not interested, hung up. And they were going to double his salary to go to Arkansas. And so I'm at the Final Four. I fly home, and we've been at K-State. You got to understand now. I told my wife that we're going to move to Manhattan. She thought it was about Manhattan, New York, where she's from.
Yeah.
And when I said, oh, my God, I'd already told Huggs we're in, and I'm on the phone, and she's yelling, we're going to Manhattan. All right. I was like, Manhattan, Kansas. There was silence. And I was like, yeah, hon, it's going to be a great time. And she says, we'll talk when we get home, and hung up on me. So Huggs says, we good? I say, yeah, she's happy. We're fine. We're good to go. So now here we are a year later.
Right.
And I got to tell her that we're moving to Morgantown, West Virginia.
West Virginia, yes.
And I said, well, I'm getting divorced. It is what it is. She's going back to the East Coast, and I'm done. Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable ride. And then John Weefald, who was the president at the university at the time, Bob Krause, who was the vice president, who had been there for 20 years, who passed away a couple years ago. And Tim Weiser, who's the athletic director, who's now the associate commissioner in the Big 12. Huggs resigned on Thursday. They called me Thursday afternoon. I met with them. I was in a car headed to the airport to get on the plane with Huggs. I had a gold tie and a blue sport coat, and I was headed to get on the plane with Huggs on a different car than him to get on the plane to fly to Morgantown for his introductory press conference. And I got a call from the AD, and he says, where are you at? I told him I'm at the house with the wife trying to talk this thing through. I was actually headed to the airport. And he says, I need to meet with you in an hour. I said, okay. I hung up. I called Hugs. Hugs said, you need to go back because I think I convinced them to hire you. They were so mad at me that I don't know if they're going to listen to me, but I think they're convinced that you're the guy. So I went home. I changed. I went in, met with the AD. That night, I went to the president's house, met with the AD, the vice president, the president. The next morning, me and Delonte Hill went in and met with the AD, the president, and the vice president, and they offered us the job. And I was the lowest paid head coach in the league, and he was the highest paid assistant in the league. And it's the way I wanted it. I wanted it, you know, I didn't want to be a stopgap. It's the only thing I told those guys when I interviewed. You guys just want to keep Michael Beasley, hire someone else on the staff. If you do it because you believe in me and you go give me a chance, I'm all in. And they believed in me. And I said, I ain't stupid now. I wanted Delonte to stay. He and I had a great relationship, and that meant Beasley's coming too. And Delonte, by the way, he got a lot of bad reviews back then by jealous people.
Sure.
Unbelievable basketball coach. Unbelievable human being. And so he stays. We take the job. Here comes Bees. Bill was already, you know, Bill Walker was already there. Jacob Pullen. I bring Denny Clement in as a transfer, redshirted that first year. And away we went, man. An incredible ride.
All right. Two things. One, and you're a man of your word, and I know you're busy, and I got to go too. Can I get a part two so that I can get the, because I want a little bit of Beasley. I want the South Carolina. I want the other stuff. Can I get a promise in a part two?
The promise is done. Now you want to do that now or?
No. I don't have a time on that, but what I do have is this one thing to wrap it up. Considering you self-admitted, not a great player, all these different jobs, deciding to leave high school where you were incredibly successful in Miami. That's the part that you buried, right? State championships and all these players to go to college and the bouncing around. What was it like to go back to tell your wife, I'm a head coach at Kansas State?
Here's a great story of that moment, Doug. We're in this big ballroom by the president's office, and it's Delonte and I in two chairs. And it's this huge table, and way on the other side is the president, the vice president, and the AD. And they make their presentation, and they're like way on the other side of the room. They say, we want to offer you, Frank, the head coaching job, and we're going to pay you $600,000 a year. And we want Delonte to be the associate head coach, if that's okay with you, Frank, and we're going to pay Delonte $400,000 a year. Delonte and I sat there, and we're just staring. Neither one of us moves. We don't say a word. We don't look at each other. And now the president kind of sits back in his chair. He looks nervous. He's like, do you guys need a minute to talk about this? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So he goes, please step outside. So we step outside the room. We're like, yo, these dudes offered us the job. Are you kidding me? These guys offered us the job. So we go back in and we're like, we're in. We shake hands, and then we called our wives. Delonte called his. We're next door neighbors. Delonte calls his wife. I call my wife. They're both crying on the phone. We hang up. They both run outside, and our kids at the time, where my daughter was a little jit and his oldest daughter was real, they run outside. They're all celebrating in the front of the house. And, you know, we're back in there with the AD trying to make plans to fly to Memphis that night to go meet with Michael Beasley, who's with USA Basketball, getting ready to be in Memphis, to play in Memphis. And unbelievable moment, man, the joy. And then we called our moms, because he's just like me, raised by his mom. Yeah. Then we called our moms, and then they start crying. It was a powerful moment in our lives, and we shared that moment together.
I want to pause our conversation with that and really appreciate your time. And we'll look forward to part two.
We'll do it, man. Looking forward to it.
All right. That's the end of part one with my Frank Martin interview. My appreciation to him and to you for downloading, rating, and of course, subscribing. Review us. Make sure you give us a good rating. A reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is available daily from 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 through Pacific on your iHeartRadio app, on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com. You can stream us wherever you want. We're also on SiriusXM 217 and 203. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for part two. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.